Michael Fleif received his PhD at Cornell University and for the past 10 years has been with ARS at the Forage Animal Production Unit in Lexington. He holds an adjunct faculty appointment at the University of Kentucky in the Department of Animal and Food Sciences. His research focus is on manipulating microbial processes in the gut of cattle, ruminants, and horses to improve animal performance, health, and welfare. Michael?
This forwards it, right?
Yeah, this. Okay.
That's our pointer. Oh, very good. Well, first I'd like to say thanks for inviting me to talk here and inviting me to represent ruminants and the ruminant industry here. It's the first two talks are a tall act to follow, so great talks, and thanks for letting me be a part of this. It's no secret that drugs are used in food animal production. This is a large feed yard in Amarillo, Texas. I won't name them, but we can think of them as being very representative of the industry. I had the opportunity to talk to one of their nutritionists. We actually had a meeting here in Phoenix in 2014, 2 years ago, about ractopamine residuals in the meat. And he said at that time that all of the animals that came through this yard, that's 20,000 at that particular location, received ractopamine, they received Tylosin, Monensin, and many of them received chlorotetracycline. So ractopamine is a beta adrenergic agonist. It improves blood flow in the periphery and influences deposition, partitioning of mass into the skeletal muscle versus the viscera. It's not an antibiotic, but these others are. Tylosin is a macrolide antibiotic. It is given to prevent liver abscesses. You put cattle on high-grain diets. All of them will have liver abscesses if they don't receive something to prevent it. Monensin is an ionophore. It's given to ameliorate the effects of rumen acidosis, keep pH down. It's also a good coccidiostat. Chlorotetracycline is, of course, a tetracycline. It's given for pink eye and a lot of other things, but very many animals receive it at some point in their life. So these antibiotics are also growth promoters, and this is one of the most misunderstood functions of antibiotics in ruminant feeding. So you can give these antibiotics to perfectly healthy animals and promote weight gain and promote feed efficiency. So when consumers learn about this use of antibiotics, when they learn that we're giving antibiotics to healthy animals, they juxtapose that against information like this, projections that antibiotic resistance is on the rise. And so here's where we are right now, about 70,000 mortalities per year from antibiotic-resistant infections. And the projection by this group is that by 2050 that it would pass cancer as a leading cause of death. And so when they take these two pieces of information, we're giving healthy animals antibiotics, and we have this huge problem with antibiotic resistance, they say, just tell them not to do that. Tell them, you know, that doesn't make any sense. That's a misuse. And so tell them not to do that. Done. We have a veterinary feed directive that was passed by the FDA that goes into effect in January. It does a number of things. So the beta agonist, ractopamine, which again is not an antibiotic, but that was already off of the menu, it had become a trade barrier because other people were detecting it in pork and in beef. Growth promotion as a labeled use will be gone, and so you can't simply give antibiotics for growth promotion anymore. That won't be allowed. Monensin, as I said, and a lot of the other ionophores are also very good coccidiostats, so they can still be given as coccidiostats. The macrolides and the tetracyclines will be by prescription only, so under the supervision of a veterinarian. And so I think it remains to be seen how that all is going to shake out. It's probably going to depend on the size of the producer and a lot of other things. So large operations can have a staff veterinarian, and if they need it, if there are liver abscesses or if there's pink eye or something, they'll be able to give those drugs for the smaller yards they would have to bring somebody in to do that, and so of course that represents a cost to them. I'm not sure exactly how this is all going to happen. But growth promotion is something we're not supposed to even talk about anymore. But should we give up on growth promotion and feed efficiency? I'm going to make the case that no, we shouldn't. And the most obvious reason, of course, is food security. This audience, of course, will be very familiar with this figure and this concept that we have a very daunting task in front of us to feed an unprecedented number of people, more than we've ever had to feed. And so the idea of producing less food is unpalatable from that stance. Our agency, ARS, is taken to calling this a grand challenge, which I think is a very optimistic, very positive way to look at what's a very daunting task in front of us. But there are also environmental reasons not to give up on growth promoters. There are environmental consequences for taking them away. And to see the environmental aspects, we have to know how antibiotic growth promoters work. I've been to some meetings on antibiotics and antibiotic efficacy recently. Some of my colleagues have made statements like, we don't even really know how antibiotic growth promoters work. Well, they're wrong. We do. It may not be something you learned in vet school, and you have to dig into some of the literature to find it, but we have textbooks on how these things work. So it is known. And we have to start with the rumen and how it works in ruminant animals. And so ruminants differ from other animals, from monogastrics. Let me see if this works. Oh, sorry, we're skipping ahead. I don't know that I have a pointer. Touchpad? Oh, there we go. So very good. So ruminants differ from something like a horse in that they have this chamber, the rumen, just on the other side of the esophagus, that is a home for microorganisms, symbiotic microorganisms, that help them deconstruct lignocellulose and other plant material. And this is the rumen, the entire gastrointestinal tract of a goat. This big chamber right here is the rumen. The omasum and the abomasum aren't shown, and so the abomasum is the gastric stomach. The cecum is shown, the large intestine, small intestines are shown. And so it's an organ, it's a habitat for a very dense consortium, community of microorganisms, and it's a fermentation, and it's some of these fermentative pathways that we have to understand to show you how antimicrobial growth promoters work. So in this figure here, if we think about this top box as being the activities of the microbes in the rumen, and think about the bottom box as being the physiological activities of the animal host. Fiber comes into the rumen. It can be deconstructed by bacteria and other microorganisms into sugars, fermented into acids. Some of those acids are turned into other acids, which can then be absorbed by the animal. Propionate is very important, a bacterial product. A grazing animal gets all of its blood sugar from propionate through gluconeogenesis in the liver. So there's some value to the host there. These other acids can be used in lipid biosynthesis. Some other products of this fermentation are hydrogen, which is a very important electron sink in the rumen, so very important to the fermentative process. That hydrogen is then used by methanogens, and the methane is eructated. And that is one of the first places where antimicrobial growth promoters can act. So you can get a reduction in hydrogen production, and you get a shift in these acids. Also, if you're giving starch, starch is the main carbohydrate, not cellulose, not fiber. You can protect some of that starch. It'll make it into the lower digestive tract of the animal where it can be absorbed and used much in the way that monogastric animals, non-ruminants, use carbohydrates. So energy for the animal. Proteins, the same thing. So proteins can undergo proteolysis by bacteria and other microorganisms, can be converted into peptides and amino acids. The amino acids can be decarboxylated into amines, or they can be deaminated to make ammonia and VFAs. The ammonia can enter the host where it's converted into urea. Some of that urea is recycled, and from urea or ammonia you can get production of microbial protein, which is then available to the animal. But a lot of it is lost in the urine. And that's completely accidental where the urine is coming out over the logo of that agency. I didn't mean to do that. It just worked out that way. And so that deamination step, the bacteria that convert amino acids into ammonia, is a second place where antimicrobial growth promoters can act. And so they can reduce the ammonia produced from amino acids. When that happens, protein, amino acids, peptides, even microbial protein is protected. It gets down into the lower digestive tract of the animal, where then it can be used by the animal and converted into animal protein. So if we pan out and look at the big picture here, the interaction with this system with the whole environment, and so you can follow the nitrogen, and I've got some carbon on here too. Mostly we're following the nitrogen. So if you start with fertilizer, you're going to use that fertilizer to make plant protein. And, you know, I have a pasture shown here, a grass pasture, but we're talking about cereals too, of course. The plant protein you're going to feed to the animals to make animal protein that enters the human food supply. And so this audience knows better than anybody, knows better than me, the losses from this system when you land apply this nitrogen, that you can get nitrogen lost both into the water and to the air. Also, due to the activity of these rumen microorganisms, you can get nitrogen lost into the ground, or you can also get methane, carbon that's lost from the system. And it's a non-trivial amount. I didn't include any numbers here, but I'd direct you to work by Luis Tedeschi and Danny Fox for specific numbers on this. But a back-of-the-envelope calculation, a feed yard like the one that I showed you on the first slide, that's putting through 20,000 animals every 100 days, you know, they might lose 400,000 pounds of protein from this process. That much can be saved through antibiotic use. In any case, so you have urea and nitrate that end up in the water. You have these gases, which are greenhouse gases, which end up in the atmosphere, not to mention you have natural gas, a fossil fuel that's used in the Haber-Bosch process to make the fertilizer to begin with. And we can make the process more efficient through an antibiotic growth promoter at the expense of creating antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So I think that's how this problem fits into the One Health concept. The NSF has taken to calling these nexus problems. And so this is, I think, maybe the take-home slide. It's not without hope, though. There are a lot of us who are interested in alternatives for ruminant growth promotion. That's what our group in Lexington works on. And there are a lot of good candidates for this that can be applied in different situations. We focus on phytochemicals in our group, which we like to think of as functional feed, borrowing a term from human nutrition that's popular now, thinking of functional foods, meaning a food that has some value beyond its nutritional component, of what we typically think of as nutrients. Our best success to date is with isoflavones from red clover. So this is a structure of isoflavones for anybody who might not be familiar with them. This one shows formininette and biocannin A, which are present in our red clover. They act selectively on this group of ammonia-producing bacteria. They decrease the number of bacteria and decrease the ammonia in the rumen. We discovered them in the laboratory. I'm just going to breeze through these slides. Not very data-heavy, but we discovered it in a biologically guided assay. We have a feeding trial complete now that shows that it does, in fact, act as a growth promoter, that we can increase the average daily gain of steers when they're fed these isoflavones. So what we like about clover, it's a legume for one thing. It doesn't require the nitrogen inputs. It's inexpensive compared to other phytochemicals. People can afford it. In fact, many of our producers can make it themselves. The effective doses can be found in something you could actually feed by feeding clover hay or by grazing clover. We have reasonable assumptions about its safety because our animals have been eating it all along. They're evolved to eat it. They are phytoestrogens, And so we're talking about it in growing animals, not necessarily in your open cows. And so we have to be at least a little bit cautious about our breeding animals. And it works. So just kind of as a summary statement, to go back to the One Health idea, at least I think it fits in with the One Health idea, is if I were to tell you all the great things that we've discovered about this compound, you'd say, Flife, you know, you're just trying to sell clover. It sounds that way. The idea that we could replace several antibiotics and we could replace ractopamine and reduce heat stress and all these other wonderful things by feeding clover, you're going to say, you know, you're really going to replace all these drugs with something out of clover? No, it's really the other way around. It's we have to feed all these drugs because we're not feeding our animals what they're evolved to eat. So that's what I have. Thanks. Yes, sir. That we need more meat, yeah.
You know, unless there's going to be somebody like the LPS government to buy it and ship it to places soon, which I doubt that's going to happen. But I hear it's going to be the efficiency part. So we do need to benefit from improving the feed efficiency. But are you really sure that this is like a free pass to the finish and that there isn't some downside, negative, you know, consequences to that? It's hard for me to believe that this. Without some potential for the evolution of some microbial species, it might sometime, you know, lead to some problems with human beings.
There could be, and we have done some work on the mechanism of action of these things too. See, any candidate we would want not only to not be an antibiotic, but not share a mechanism of action with an antibiotic. In this case, this one doesn't, that we know of. There are downsides to this. Like I said, it's a phytoestrogen too. And one place where we need more protein too is in our dairies. And I think this is going to have very limited, if any, application in dairies. And of course, there are clover is pretty widespread, but there are places in the world where we can't grow clover too. And there's a lot of other legumes that we have to look at. There are other possibilities too. Sure, I agree. Let me repeat the question. I didn't at first. So the excess meat production and excess milk production, and do we really need to, focus on growth promotion or increasing milk production in a time when we have excess? I would conjecture too, maybe that we need to look beyond what's happening right now or what's happening in the next few years to longer term. We have a lot of people to feed. Sometimes it's difficult to predict what people will want to eat and what people will eat. So in a time when beef consumption is going down, you look at pork consumption in Asia. And so it's not they're not eating meat, it's that they're eating different meat. Could you repeat the question for me?
That growth promoters tend to make the animals more resilient to disease, and therefore it can actually reduce use of antibiotics for treatment. I
haven't heard that argument exactly. So the question was that you could make the animals more resilient, more robust against disease.
The argument I heard, I was wondering if it's...
Yeah. Except that you can promote growth in healthy animals that don't have an elevated white blood cell count at all.
Isn't it an argument that most good health
So the question was, or the comment was, affecting the gut lining and affecting maybe the microflora that grow on the gut lining. Yeah, and I don't know that I've seen data relevant to that, and it's difficult to show that those animals are unhealthy.
In healthy
animals, yeah.
There will be a discussion period afterwards, too, so you can certainly return to the topic. Okay, the last speaker, Ed Topp. Ed is the principal research scientist with Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada and also has adjunct appointments with the Department of Biology at Western University in London, Ontario, and the Department of Soil and Water Sciences at the University of Florida. He has led several national studies that seek to better understand and to better manage the risk that food production practices pose for environmental quality and human health. He is a former president of the Canadian Society of Microbiologists. Ed? Oh, okay. Sorry.